All right, I think we'll start, even though few will be coming yet. What you need, as usual, is a Bible, and if you would like, you can pick up a copy of the translation I have of Philippians 2, verses 5 to 11, that I hope at times is helpful. And today we will take a look at Philippians chapter 2, verses 9 to 11, which would be the second stanza of this hymn or this poem. So far we've been spending time on verses 6 through 8 primarily, which is simply summarized as the humiliation stanza. And again, what's key in that, right? We can't forget, although, or because, A, not B, but C, 1 and 2 there. And you all know what that means, so we won't go over that again. But we need to keep that in mind when we get to verses 9 through 11, stanza 2, which can be simply summarized as the exaltation section. And verse 9 starts there, on account of this, God has indeed exalted him most highly. And then we're going to talk about the exaltation. And what this will do is help us understand, again, in terms of the title, we're talking about cruciform Christ, cruciform God, cruciform church. We've talked about cruciform Christ and church and individuals. Today, the exaltation is actually going to be talking about a cruciform God. So the first thing we're going to do is have a little intro to philosophy class, or maybe an intro to philosophy of religion class, to say that all the way from the pre-Socratics, right, those philosophers before Socrates, like Heraclitus and Parmenides, all the way down in Western philosophical tradition through to Hegel, there has been a very basic understanding of divinity or God. And it's been seen in terms of what is usually called the hierarchy of being. And the hierarchy of being designates that there are, in terms of the entire universe, three basic substances, natures, realms, beings, anything like that. Anybody want to take a stab at the three various realms?
Oh,
a stab. That's a stab.
God, human, creature.
That's pretty close. At least you... There's God. God is on the top of the hierarchy. Any guesses on what's at the bottom?
Demons?
Nope. Animals. Actually, demons are pretty high.
Oh. Animals.
Okay, well, let's do...
How about physical beings and spiritual beings?
We'll put humans here, that's right. Spiritual beings, angels, demons would be here. Somebody said animals. We'll put those here.
So inanimate objects?
Inanimate stuff. Okay, we'll put that down here. We'll just call that matter.
Is that the bottom?
Well, yeah, but we could go one more down here if you want.
Plants?
Fire.
Plants. No, plants go here.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I wasn't thinking of you.
Oblivion.
What's that second?
Oblivion, that's pretty good. We can just call it.
How about dark matter?
Or space?
How about nothing?
Nothing.
Right, which again brings us to a basic philosophical question, right? Why is there something rather than nothing? Great final exam question for Philosophy 101.
Yeah,
so from this, right, obviously nothing is on the bottom of the hierarchy. God is at the top. From this, there are then seen as three realms. There is the realm of the divine. There is the realm of the intelligible, which sometimes is just simply called the realm of soul or mind. Mental substance, if you're Cartesian, with your mind-body dualism. And the third realm is the material world. And so humans, you can see, are right here in the middle, because humans have got soul and body, right? Or material and intelligible and all of that kind of stuff. So as we work at that, and of course philosophers throughout history then have been working out what the distinctions are between these various things and so on and so forth. Okay, today our concern is God. If we have to describe who God is, what are the attributes you would give to God?
Omni everything.
There we go. All our omnis come in here, precisely. So what are the omnis?
Omnipotent, omniscient,
omnipresent.
Omnipresent.
I can never see too close up here, right? Omnipresent. That's good. What else have we got?
So are we talking character traits?
What? Sure.
Okay, so grace, full of grace and mercy.
No.
Okay.
We're trying to destroy or
Creator.
Well, that's the omnipotent part. All right. Eternal. Yeah. Anything else?
Well, if you have nothing at the bottom, it's all at the top.
All knowing.
Oh, yeah.
Is that
all knowing is omniscient.
On all of them.
Infinite.
Now, wouldn't those go with omnipresent, kind of eternal and infinite?
Nope, they're understood to be different.
Oh.
Because just because you're present everywhere doesn't mean you would be eternal.
Oh, okay.
Oh. Infinite, impassable is the technical name. What does it mean if you're impassable? Which, you know, you confront some cars on the highway like that sometimes.
There's nothing more.
You can't move.
Unable to ignore.
No change. No suffering. Right? No pasio, passion, change. Let's see, omnipotent. Oh yeah, we've got a first couple others here. Necessary being. What would that mean?
He holds the universe together.
Yeah, and not only holding it together, but
designing.
Okay, that would be
acting.
Another one, right? The grand designer. But if you're a necessary being, as opposed to a contingent being. It means what?
Without God, there is nothing.
Yeah, and in terms of your own self, you are uncaused. You have to be.
Meaning?
Wait, say that again.
You have to be. It's necessary.
So it's
rather than being contingent. We're all contingent.
Oh, okay.
We come in and out of existence. We don't have to be.
Okay.
God must be. be.
Oh, okay.
Got it.
So God must be.
Necessary.
God must be.
Those are, I think we've got them all here. Basically, in terms of the Western philosophical tradition, the understandings of what it is to be divine. God has these attributes, right? Heraclitus would have said that, Plato would have said that, Aristotle would have said that, quite frankly, Augustine would have said that, Thomas Aquinas said this, you know, his five ways for the existence of God, all of that. Descartes, Kant, Hegel, they all say this. It works its way into our tradition. Certainly, theologically, we very often think about this in terms of our own understanding of God as well. Think about that hymn that starts out, immortal, invisible, God only wise. I hate that hymn. It's bad theology, right? I mean, it's saying nice things about God, but quite frankly, the point I want to make here, based on Paul, is he's not our God, right? But anyway, that's now it becomes interesting, right? This is the way the Western philosophical, and we could say theological tradition understands God. Now,
did you say Western theological tradition understands God?
Yeah.
As, but not Eastern understanding of God?
Well, I what I mean there by the West is I mean Eastern Orthodoxy is in on this.
Okay,
but what
okay.
I'm saying is this is not,
but this is Judaic too, right?
A Buddhist or a Hindu or a Confucian understanding.
But,
yes, Jewish.
And Muslim, would they say the same thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Monotheist.
Yeah, theism, deism, all of that kind of stuff would hold to this.
Okay.
So, now the question is, my good biblical experts, as you look at verses 9 to 11, what does Paul say are the attributes of God?
His name is above every name.
Okay.
Jesus the Messiah.
All right, so there's an identity made between Jesus and God. So that means, right, what everything that was said in verses 6 to 8 about Jesus can now also be said about God.
God is gracious because he freely bestows.
Okay. Yeah, that way of talking about freely bestows is precisely, again, that sense of gracious.
But the only thing is that all should be to the glory of God.
Okay, so we're back to glory.
So Jesus' glory brings glory to God.
And what
the Father.
And what would be meant by glory?
Done this before.
We did. Yeah, I know. Isn't that always
yeah,
the
what
topic?
Was that?
Exodus 33.
Generous.
When
oh, yeah.
Moses is up there
class,
on the
right,
mountain
yeah.
and wants to see God's glory, and what happens?
He sees
the backside.
The backside of
God. He sees his buttocks.
Yeah.
But God also says something there. What does God say?
Full of grace and mercy.
Yeah. I will be gracious to whom I will be gracious, and I will be merciful to whom I will be merciful. So again, glory is linked up with grace and mercy. And if it's I want to be gracious, merciful to whom I want to be gracious and merciful, it's God's true freedom or a little more fancy here. God is unconditioned, right? Because to be truly free means you're not constrained by any conditions. So that I can't fly on my own because gravity constrains me. It's a condition that I would need to overcome if I want to fly. God's unconditioned. All right? Anything else in there about God?
So the possibility of universal salvation, that door can never be closed.
That's right.
Doesn't guarantee it, but it doesn't. You can't close it.
That's right. Let's say again, to take it into the area of predestination, one of the disagreements between Luther and Calvin, right? Calvin has double predestination in terms of before the foundations of the world, God determined who would be saved and who would be condemned. Right? So it was like the great checklist that God was here going, save, save them, save them, save them, them, save. And that's how it is. And, you know, Luther and the others go, no. Predestination is good news in terms of saying before the foundations of the world, God is already at work, working grace and mercy for all of us. And God's will is that that grace and mercy extends to all of us and we are all brought into it.
Well, and it says
and
here,
so we don't ever close the door.
So does verse 10 sort of fit in there too with that it's those who are in heaven and on earth and under the earth? So is it a reconciliation of all of creation?
Yeah, very good. So that we've got the whole sense here is, that's a good way to put it, all creation is reconciled. Right. And of course, above the earth, on the earth, under the earth is the old the Jewish cosmic view, right? There are three spheres. That's Genesis 1. It's the science of the day, right? You've got the heavens, and you've got the earth, and then you've got beneath the earth, or another way of looking at that is the water, and of course the pillars that keep it going. And just a little bit more, right? In Genesis 1, you see in terms of creation, God being a God of order, you put everything where they're supposed to be. So that if you've got water, what you have to do is create swimmers, we call them fish. If you've got earth, you create creepers, King James calls them beasts of the field, and here in the heavens, you've got flyers. We call them birds. And that becomes part of, within the priestly tradition, the whole understanding of kosher. And part of kosher is you don't want to mix up these three areas. So for example, that's why you don't eat frogs. Why wouldn't you eat frogs?
Because they're a swimmer in land.
Because they start out in the water and then they creep, right? They're just a very kind of confused creature. Yeah. We don't eat confused creatures. Right. All of that. Yeah.
Right. But at its simplest form, all that this person is saying is that everything is covered.
Right.
So if we would translate that to our understanding of the universe, all of creation, it's all of creation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that, so in that way we don't get lost in the, in the.
We don't have to, it's just simply saying that that phrase that Paul is using here, right? Those in the heavens, those upon the earth, those beneath the earth, is precisely using, if you will, the Jewish cosmological system. What it means is precisely all creation. Okay? So, anything else?
It says every knee should bend, so I'm thinking that's a form of honoring.
Okay. The bending knee is indeed a sense of honor. And there the question would be, is this the same kind of honor that the Roman world would have thought of for honor? Remember, we had talked about shame and honor. The bending knee, you're right, it is honor, but what kind of honor is it?
Allegiance?
Affirmation?
Humble.
All right. The
humiliation.
Worshipping.
Worshipping.
Yeah, I guess in my mind I have a bit. I mean, it's like two things that would bring you to your knees. One would be fear.
Yeah.
Right.
And then the other one would be adoration, worship.
Awe.
Yeah.
Yep, and we could do that. The other one that comes in here again that fits in with 6 to 8 is this notion of obedience. Right? Because remember, you know, you can think about that too. You know, a king gives a command and then you bow and out you go. If you're obeying the command, it's obedience, but again, done out of loyalty, allegiance, awe, respect, a sense of orientation, right? You're oriented toward that one whom, again, you know, in this instance, bestows grace and mercy. Okay? So now, how does all of this differ from all those other ways we said we think about God in the West, omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, eternal, infinite, necessary cause, or necessary being? And why would that make a difference? Why would I even want to waste your time on this?
Pretty comparable to Jesus messes it all up.
Yeah, it is comparable to Jesus messes it all up.
Well, the other ones seem like God is out there.
Right.
Unapproachable. No way we can know and understand and relate to or be in relationship with. That's just way out there.
The other side of it, it defines God. And anytime you define, then you control.
Let me write a few of these things down because this is good stuff too. You know all this. Right? I mean, one of the key, I'll just, right, the notion that God is so transcendent, if you will, absolutely transcendent, that God is unreachable, untouchable, you can't get at him. The other thing here is that, I'll just put it right, this is a God of law, right? Principles, and of course, understood as the one who will always judge you.
So, when you first asked the question about the difference between the two, I guess my initial thought was that I didn't think that this here necessarily precluded the other characteristics being Correct, and I kind of agree with Steph, is that Jesus kind of messed it up, and that he does, he changes God essentially from this transcendent being that is difficult to get to know to now we have, I mean, the Bible says Jesus is the exact representation of God, and that's somebody that we can relate to or maybe understand some of what he's trying to teach us.
I get the feeling that somehow we have now a role in, that's not in who God is, but that it seems like I feel like I'm part of these later verses here. Confessing Jesus Christ or bending my knee.
That's right. This whole business here about the bending knee and obedience and all of that, as well as this understanding of reconciled, right? Reconciled is a relationship. There's got to be two. You're going to have reconciliation. So if there's God on the one hand, the good news is you're on the other hand.
Well, doesn't Genesis say that we are created in the image of God?
Yeah.
Hey, and when I think about the Exodus passage, I think that God, my understanding just now is thinking about how God has been trying to communicate this to us for quite a while, even before Jesus.
Yes.
That I am, not just those other things, but I'm grace and mercy.
Yeah.
And,
So you think, I'm looking at the God of law, and so I don't know, I don't know why I was fully developed, but, you know, if you go back to Genesis, God created us to be in relationship with him. And, you know, it talks about that in the evenings, God would come and stroll through the garden with Adam. And then Adam and Eve messed it up and got booted. And so the law says when you disobey, you die. When you eat of the fruit, you die. Right? And so that's where we were. Until Jesus came and fulfilled the law, and then, you know, so then God's graciousness is able to reach us again, or to, you know, restore that relationship or satisfy the law.
Yeah, I think there it's more a sense that Jesus provides the alternative to law, such that the law no longer matters, so that the understanding of salvation and reconciliation is such that it's not the work of Jesus is so that we can now make the law work for us. Rather, the work of Jesus is that the law is no longer necessary in achieving reconciliation, justification, all of that with God, right? We are now justified, as Paul would say in Romans, apart from works of the law. So the law no longer matters.
When you said it works for us, can you explain that?
What, that it does?
I mean, are you saying that
the law doesn't work for us?
Okay.
Right. But no longer, we don't need that. Luther's way of talking about this, he would say, he talks about, and he does this in his lectures, so he has to be Latin about it. He talks about Deus absconditus and Deus nudus. Ooh, I know. Who thought this would be an odd Deus abscond, right? To abscond means you're hidden, you run away. This is the hidden God. And again, Luther would say, sinful human beings left to their own reason create the hidden God, which is the omnis, eternal, infinite, blah, 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 God. Luther calls that as well the God of the philosophers, and he says to all people, run, run away from the god of the philosophers. Then, of course, the other one is you have the Deus Nudus, right? The bare-naked god. And where do you see the bare-naked god?
On the cross.
On the cross, right? There again, if you want to, you can say the Deus Nudus was precisely Philippians 2, 6 to 8. That's the bare naked God, as opposed to our Canadian singing group, the Bare Naked Ladies. Right? That, and so Luther, Paul, what we're going at here is, right, through Christ we see God, if you will, in all of God's nakedness. Right. No more cover-ups. And again, the sense there is that's what human reason left to its own devices will do. Cover up the real God, the true God, and construct this nice, logical, reasonable, because all those omnis and eternal, infinite, necessary cause and all of that. Believe me, I can razzle dazzle you with the logical arguments for all of that, right? I teach that stuff. So I can, you know, and it can be quite convincing. And it certainly is logical, but you see, the great thing about logic that I always tell students too, remember, all logic and reason will do is tell you if something is valid. It will not tell you if it's true. Right. Simple syllogism. This will be a logical argument, but not necessarily true. All Holden villagers are tree-hugging granola eaters. Daryl is a Holden villager, therefore he is a tree-hugging granola eater.
Ooh, ooh, ooh.
That is a perfectly valid argument. Wonderful syllogism. But not necessarily true.
Chop that tree.
Chop that tree. Right. And of course, that's the thing with all of our logical arguments, our rational constructs of God. They're all valid. They're all very reasonable. But, as Paul and all within the Christian tradition claim, is not true. Okay? So far, so good. Or so far, thanks Jesus, you've messed it all up again. All right, let's take a look at a few other places where Paul talks about this stuff and to see if he can help us understand that. The first one I want to go to is 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18 to 25. 1 Corinthians 1, 18 to 25. And anyone who has it, please read it.
For the message about the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise, and the discernment of the discerning I will thwart. Where is the one who is wise? Where is the scribe? Where is the debater of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of the world? For since in the wisdom of God, the world did not know God through wisdom, God decided through the foolishness of our proclamation to save those who believe. For Jews demand signs, and Greeks desire wisdom. But we proclaim Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Gentiles. But to those who are the called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For God's foolishness is wiser than human wisdom, and God's weakness is stronger than human strength.
Okay. So you can see there, obviously, Paul's turning it all topsy-turvy. But what are, let's say, some particular phrases that might jump out at you that help to, I hope, solidify the point I'm trying to make?
Well, the one where it says, we preach Christ crucified, the naked God, which is a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Greek, or to the Gentiles.
Right. And destroy their wisdom.
And stumbling block, again, the Greek word for that is scandalon. We can say, another way of talking about it is we find that scandalous.
I will destroy the wisdom of the wise and the discernment of the discerning. I will thwart.
Yeah, I know. So.
You think you're so smart.
So what about this right there at the beginning? The cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, the power of God.
Mm-hmm.
So the cross is foolishness or the power of God.
Yeah.
So what do you, let me just ask you another question. So what are you going to say to Richard Dawkins? You know, anybody know Richard Dawkins and his book? He and, you know, Christopher Hitchens and Sam Harris are the three biggies who wrote those, best-selling books that, you know, said all this God nonsense. No, nobody's read any of that. Richard Dawkins is an evolutionary biologist.
Oh.
And he just says, you know, given evolutionary biology and all of that, any talk about God and everything is just nonsense and foolishness. And, you know, the quicker the human race, you know, understands that and goes to the world of science and reason, the better off we'll all be.
But God is foolish.
I know. So,
well,
so.
But the interesting thing is I was reading an article about somebody who had that same premise, and basically what he's saying is that people have used the excuse of the existence of God not to take care of what we've been given.
Mm-hmm.
God's going to take care of us anyway, God's coming back, or Jesus is coming back, blah, blah, blah. So he was saying that needs to just get thrown away. And I think God might say the same thing. That just because you believe in God doesn't mean you think that you. It's kind of that A, not B, but C kind of argument.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the other side of it, where you use these philosophical understandings of God to justify exploitation,
right,
and ransacking all of creation,
right,
and all of that. Yeah, so it can, you know, it can go on either side.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think this isn't answering your question, but kind of following up on what you're talking about. I think part of when you read some of Scripture, it talks in the New Testament, like the epistles of John talk about, you know, they'll know us, or you'll be identified by your love, by the acts that you do. And I think, you know, when you look at what the world perceives the church, we're doing a whole bunch of things we shouldn't be messing with. We shouldn't, I mean, it's like,
yeah,
we're so worried about law or doctrine or whatever and being pure in that we're ignoring what we're called to be. This, you know, we're supposed to be out there washing the feet of the poor and helping, you know. And I think if we were doing that, we would have an answer to Richard Dawkins and some of those others. But we, as a group, as a, you know,
mm-hmm,
what we see, kind of the popular culture of Christianity in the United States especially, that's not happening. That's not what's perceived. And people are very disgusted with the church and the,
mm-hmm,
and the message that's out there. So I think that's the condemnation on us, that we're spending all our time on the wrong,
mm-hmm,
things.
Mm-hmm. Because again, right, precisely because to link this up with verses 6-8, right, where again, when we see this, when we look at these kinds of characteristics here,
right,
again, we're saying, right, because we know now what all this means, that God is self-emptying and self-humbling. Those are God's characteristics. And those are Christ's characteristics, and those are now our characteristics, right? And so, you know, unfortunately, the church has bought into much more that Roman way of understanding. We would like to be Augustus, right? And think about, you know, things that we don't talk of, terms we don't use so much anymore, but I mean, at least still when I was young, that you always talked about, right? Remember, the church militant? Right? You know, or again, the church triumphant,
mm-hmm.
right? That whole notion of triumphalism, that whole notion of domination, it was much more present in our hymns, right? If you go back to the Red Book.
Christian soldier.
I mean, the hymns kind of fell into two categories. They were either very penitential kind of hymns, you know, I'm really bad, I'm really bad, I'm a sinner, please God forgive me, or they were these very triumphalistic hymns, right, you know, like Onward Christian, and, you know, and we're all doing that, and so when you put those two together, they always come up with, and I know many of you have heard this before, right, my favorite hymn. Right? Chief of sinners though I be, everyone else is worse than me. Right? Because that shows you just how penitential I am, but at the same time I'm triumphant because, you know, you're all worse. Right? And so that's a paradoxical theology if ever there was one, right? And it is not the gospel. Right, because in that sense, right, you know, last night Paul said, right, we're hyper victors, right? But what? It's through Christ who loved us and gave himself for us, right? I mean, the victory again, that foolishness and everything, is seen in that self-emptying and self-humbling understanding, which now the claim is God does as well.
Yeah, and the human, I suppose you could say, the verification of that is when we see that self-emptying, that self-humbling, that self-sacrifice, or experience the love that drives that. It's the most powerful force we'll ever experience.
Right.
That's earth-changing.
Yeah.
And all humanity has some understanding of that. Stands in awe of that.
And that's the
even as they'll argue that, well, you just get yourself killed.
Yeah. And that's the point Paul wants to drive home. Right? Precisely that. I want to at least give you references, if you want, to other places that we could look at for this. 1 Corinthians chapter 2 is another place. We could look at that whole chapter if we wanted to. Another place, I think, where Paul is getting all of this, or many of his notions from, is Isaiah chapter 45. Great chapter, and maybe tomorrow we'll take a little look at that. And the other place that talks about this, which again most folks think is not written by Paul, but again is that Jewish Christian approach to things. And so you see this here. This is in Hebrews. You can find it in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 to 14. In chapter 5, verses 1 to 10, and in chapter 10, verses 5 to 10. And so those are places that as well bring in many of these things. And again, Isaiah 45, verse 23 is that quotation from Paul about every knee shall bend and all of that. He gets that from Isaiah 45:23. So those are other places within Scripture that we can look again and develop and deepen that understanding of God as revealed to us through Christ. One more question I have. We have to ask that one, and that's kind of in the title for all of this. Why is Jesus' exaltation not a promotion or a reward?
Because he's exalted in making himself low.
Yeah, but why wouldn't that be a reward? Why wouldn't we'll talk about it in terms of kind of Trinitarian. Why wouldn't God the Father say to you, Jesus, my son, emptied yourself, humbled yourself, showed all that love. Well done, suffering servant Messiah. I'm going to promote you. Here's your reward. Because that's the way that passage here, right, is often interpreted.
Yeah, it is.
Why isn't that?
Because it's freely bestowed.
You got it.
I passed.
Can I get
some?
Right. If it's freely bestowed, it means it's gracious.
No conditions.
No conditions. So the whole understanding there is this is no promotion, this is no reward, this is just simply vindicating, attesting, witnessing to God saying, good job, Jesus, you're doing what we as God should always be doing.
Yeah. Kind of who he is, who he should.
That's right, you know, kind of if you will, thank you, Jesus.
You're being God.
You're being God. Yeah. You're being who you are. You're being who we are.
And so that has everlasting value.
And that has everlasting value, and it is always, right again, it's not, right, law would be conditions, rewards, punishments, so on, right, but we're out of that game. Right? Freely bestowed is the key in showing why that can't be promotion or reward. If that's how you understand it, you misunderstand.
It's hard
you miss
for
the
humanity.
Whole point of the gospel.
It's hard for humanity to take those glasses off.
Oh, I know. Well, because everywhere else in the world, we work by rewards, promotions, everything else. Right? I mean, that's why the gospel is counterintuitive and, in that sense, countercultural. Because nobody and nothing else works that same way.
By exalted, though, does it mean risen from death?
No. The exalt here, the root there is with the sticks with that term glory. So that to exalt him means to bestow upon him glory.
Okay.
Again, the same glory as that is God's glory. Right. So exalt is linked more to glory than the resurrection.
Which kind of reminds me, like, in the Gospel of John, it's constantly talking about the hour that Jesus is lifted up, and you think, like, lifted up, like, promotion and, you know, like, the king up in the balcony, but that hour is the cross, you know, so the hour of being lifted up, the hour of glory is the hour of death and crucifixion, so it's the post.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's John's way of talking about the same thing.
Hmm. Well, to me, it's the time.
One of the few things I like about John.
To me, it's the time of the God nature and the human nature together.
Mm-hmm.
That he's gone through the crucifixion, but oh, by the way, he's God.
And in a sense, the whole way that God now works, right? Part of what is this, that we, Paul's language again, we are to be conformed to Christ. And again, why I like my little word, cruciformity, right? So that in that sense, right? What God is at work, what salvation, reconciliation is all about is basically turning us into Christ.
Hmm.
Right? And as Luther would say, what are we? We're to be little Christs to one another.
Hmm.
Right? Christ is the image of God, and we are the image of Christ. That's, so I mean, yeah, there's a very direct link to that one.
So I'd have to follow up a little bit. So the foolishness of the world, God, in God's wisdom, God, you know, kind of reveals the foolishness of the world by going to the cross and dying, by emptying God's self. Is that revealed? I'm still struggling a little bit with the cross, because is that contingent upon resurrection? Is the wisdom totally of the world debunked by God going to death in because God rises from death?
Paul's way of saying it is that the cross totally debunks it and everything, and what the resurrection shows is it vindicates that way. Or it is, you will, God's declaration of approval and attesting to all to say, see, this is the way. So I think most of the times Paul would see resurrection is vindication of the cross. That's the kind of language used.
Now, probably you have to say resurrection is instant, not right in the future.
Yeah. And I think it is...
The new life is now.
Yeah. And if you know, looking at all the resurrection narratives and everything, one will finally recognize already that resurrection is what happens to us. Right? Jesus is raised from the dead, but that also means we are raised. Because, I mean, there again, think of the disciples before the resurrection and after the resurrection, right? Before, well, they're just basically dummies. Afterwards, right, all of a sudden they understand the scriptures. They understand what God is, right? They understand that this is a God who is self-emptying and humbling, who is gracious and merciful and inclusive for all people. They didn't get that before. I think the sense of how resurrection happens to us is dramatically shown in Luke's story of the disciples on the way to Emmaus.
Hmm.
Right? I mean, you just see how that happens, as you know, their eyes were open, their hearts are burning, and all of that. And you know, they started out in despair, and
I hear death did it and resurrection vindication. However, if you truly separate it, what we often say is you can't really find life or resurrection without death. You know, you reverse that. If we're going to find daily our deaths so that we can rise again to a new day or a new moment or a new... So you can't... And then I think, well, if death really is it, and we gotta stop him, what about, you know, the suicide bombers? And that's sort of like, I mean, I can't separate resurrection from death. I understand vindication versus it's all done on the cross, but people that just taught cross lead to a place that I find very, very dark and, I don't know, I mean, suicide bombing, yay. God died and believed in death, and I will too. And, I mean, literally, death.
With the whole death resurrection. Thanks for bringing that up. That now I can put in an ad for next week, where my title is Resurrection Through Death.
Okay.
Sure. And now it will stop. We have to give Barb opportunity to set up and everything. So,
right.
Thanks, Barb.